I am Planta on the line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Charlie Demers joins me again, the comedian, author, and activist, is on to catch up on all sort of current events. Charlie will be appearing with SFU Urban Studies professor Matt Hearn on Thursday, the 27th of January, at SFU Harbor Center at 6. It's all part of SFU's History Department's year-long lecture series on the city and its history. They'll be discussing the question, Vancouver, the greatest place on earth. And Charlie would be an ideal person to discuss and debate that question, as he's the author of one of the best books on the city, Vancouver Special, which was shortlisted for the Hubert Evans Nonfiction Prize. He's also the author of a novel, Prescription Errors. Charles Demers appears on CBC Radio's The Debaters and was co-host of City TV's The City News List. Please welcome back to the Planta Online program, Charles Demers. Good morning, Mr. Demers.
Thanks, thanks, Joe. Good morning. How are you?
Very well. Yourself?
Oh, good.
I'm a little late because I just talked to Mayor Taggart and Mike Colleen from CTV News.
BC's new team.
The new team, yeah. Do you watch them? Who do you watch at 6?
And this is going to make me sound like a company man, but when I watch the local news, I watch CBC. When I watch TV news, I watch CBC.
Yeah. Now you were on when you were on City in that hour.
We were on at 6:30, and then again at 11 o'clock, and then my understanding is that when broadcast restrictions were relaxed in terms of local content quotas, that's when we were relaxed out the door. So that was almost exactly a year ago. I think we were laid off on January 19th. So all that year I was watching City. Don't get me wrong. But no, these days I am more of a CBC watcher.
Yeah, so you have a sense then of how competitive the market is, especially in that hour, right?
Oh, yes. Hugely. And the really weird thing, and which is comforting in a weird way in the kind of climate of major media consolidation and stuff, is just how different those cultures are from city to city in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
Like here, you know, when we were at City TV, City TV in Vancouver is kind of the really the sort of smaller player, and then in Toronto, it's the main.
They're number one, aren't they?
It's the main game in town, and you know, we're out in and of course Vancouver is a real global city, and I mean Western Canada in general tends to be in that kind of Can-West sort of icy embrace. I was in Halifax in December for the holidays with my family, and it was, global is, you know, essentially kind of like a little indie favorite. Like it's really strange the degree to which cities across the country really embrace a completely different. And my understanding is in Quebec they speak a whole different language, so you can take some kind of solace, I guess, in the fact that there's still a certain degree of personality from city to city. Wish the best to the new team at CTV.
Do you find that young people our age, you're not much older than I am, do you find that we watch the news, that people our age watch the news?
I don't know. I mean, my general kind of feeling is that I just don't get the news from one particular or even all that consistent a source. And I think that's probably to my detriment. I think, for instance, how up on the news I am from week to week would vary, because I don't have any kind of particular, a news ritual that I think previous generations had of, you know, waking up and reading the paper or, you know, in my household growing up, we were, my grandmother had worked for Pacific Press for decades and she retired when I was a kid and we always had both Pacific Press papers come to the house because we got them for free. It was a real newspaper reading house. These days I'm just as likely to get, you know, news from, Twitter or hear it on the radio if I happen to be driving someplace, or just whatever the case is. I usually make a point of if I'm parking a car at an hour break, I'll still just sit in the car and wait for CBC to kind of finish the hourly roundup. But at this point, I would put myself, I'm not nearly as well-informed as I was when we were doing the show on that kind of daily basis. But I would put myself at, you know, maybe like a 7 out of 10 in my generational cohort.
Yeah, I'm not home at 6 o'clock, so I find that I'm watching, like I'll watch Global or I'll watch CTV News or Tony and Gloria online. And
yeah.
I wonder, I guess people are doing that, aren't they?
I sort of feel really left out of that whole thing. I've got a pretty crummy old laptop, and I never really kind of learned how to watch TV online or anything like that, and I kind of don't want to learn how to do it, because I just feel like I'm already at my computer way more than I'd like to be. I don't want to learn how to do more things on it. It's like ridiculous that, you know, our generation's version of, you know, we have to, you know, get outside and go play is like I have to get off the computer and go watch TV to stay, you know, connected to my roots.
You're on the Twitter a lot. Do you enjoy tweeting?
I have to say, yeah, I go through little multi-day dry patches that I really don't understand. I can't figure out why. Sometimes I feel so much more fecund than at other times, but I actually really do like Twitter. I feel like it kind of strikes a better balance than Facebook. A long time ago, I kind of had to stop using Facebook as for what I had, you know, hoped I'd be able to use it, which is kind of personal stuff to keep in touch with family and friends and whatever. And I always felt too, like starting a fan page would be too immodest, and so I just ended up using my own page as a kind of professional networking thing. And whereas Twitter, I feel like, is a lot more honest about your relationship with the people in cyberspace. It's fairly informal but also, you know, fairly impersonal to the degree that you want to, manicure that presence. And I just find it's a lot of fun. And with the Tiny Earl thing, I mean, that's it's such a great mechanism for sharing. And although I do find that it's like drollness, there's maybe a little bit of droll overkill, including from me. It's like you just kind of write these sort of like pithy, what you think are pithy one-liners, and you know, that can maybe get that can maybe be a bit much. But I all in all, I really enjoy it.
Now it's an election year here in Vancouver. Are you still involved with COPE?
I am. Yeah, I give monthly to COPE, and I'm involved. I'm not nearly as involved as I was. I used to be on the executive, and I don't think I was particularly good. I'm not particularly organized in that sense, and so I generally find that the best way for me to support, you know, political causes like that is to give and to give them my time when, you know, I'm asked to MC or something like that, an event. It's funny, like you forget about the election year stuff because everything seems to be going on at the provincial and federal levels. But no, I think the civic level, it touches your life in so much more direct a way that I think people really do have a responsibility to have some kind of involvement at that level of government.
How is the mayor, how has Robertson been working out for you?
You know, I'm not a vision guy. I have a lot of criticisms. All in all, though, to be perfectly blunt, you know, I think he's been pretty good. Obviously, if there were a COPE mayoral candidate, I would vote for them. In the absence of one, you know, I think you could do a lot worse than Gregor Robertson. And as much as I hate this kind of politics of saying, like, oh, well, look how much worse it is someplace else. It really is difficult, if you're intellectually honest with yourself, to look at, like, Rob Ford and not feel like, okay, so maybe we got off pretty easy with Gregor Robertson. I think he's been okay. I mean, he's done some stuff that I certainly don't agree with. And I also am really troubled by the degree to which that the green stuff doesn't include the social inclusion. And I really think that the science shows that the best way to make a city green is not to make it kind of a green consumption paradise, but to make a city more inclusive. So you have green space and parks that are shared by people. You have mass transit that's shared by people. That means that people are consuming less of their own. It means they don't have to build these elaborate, fertilized, pesticided gardens of their own. The socializing a city makes it greener. And I would like to see more of that kind of element in what the city does. But all in all, like I said, on balance, I mean, particularly in contrast to his predecessor, I think he's been doing a pretty good job.
So, have you ever been approached to run?
Have I ever been approached to run?
Yeah.
I think I'm up to like walking briskly. that's about the level at which I can punch in. I've never been kind of formally approached to run. I think people know the answer that they'd get. I think that's there's so many more kind of organized, committed, intelligent people to do that kind of stuff. I prefer to just kind of be a loudmouth.
The you mentioned earlier the stuff going on provincially.
Yeah,
are you watching the leadership races at both parties?
I am. I mean, I'm not a particularly partisan guy. I mean, I don't tend to look at it from I know that, for instance, a lot of people, you know, in the NDP would love to see Kevin Falcon win the Liberal leadership because he's sort of less palatable, broadly speaking, than Christy Clark. I'm always one of those people that, you know, if a Kevin Falcon wins the leadership, then I'm just terrified, because what if he does win? You know, it's a funny thing. We've had all this tumult in the last year of BC politics with first in the Liberal camp, then in the NDP camp. It's been this huge kind of exciting, jostling thing. And what tends to happen in Canadian politics is you have this, like, this massive, dramatic move where people think that everything's possible, and then everything just pretty much settles back down into exactly what it was. So after all of this, you know, that we've been through over the last year, we could end up, theoretically, with Christy Clark running against Mike Farnsworth. I mean, what do those two disagree on? Like, it would be an election run completely in the center. And we could have essentially exactly what we're looking at, right, with Gordon Campbell and Carol James, which is an NDP leader about as far to the center as one could expect, and a Liberal leader pretending to be much further to the left of the center than they actually are. I am watching it. I did renew my membership in the NDP, and so I will be voting on the leader. I will be voting for leader and hoping to get involved in that way.
The way that Carol James left politics or left the leadership of the NDP, was that how it should have happened as an NDPer?
No, how it should have happened is she should have stepped down after the election in 2009. I mean that's the hard truth of it, is that, you know, her caucus never should have let her stay on after that. And the problem is, you know, the problem with assessing, you know, who acted appropriately, who acted inappropriately, you know, after the fact, the problem is that everything takes place in the shadow of that poor decision. In broad kind of inclination, my sympathies were with the Baker's Dozen or whatever, kind of the get-along gang or the apple dumpling gang or whatever they're called. I think that the person who I thought that Corky Evans' letter, you know, explaining his take on what had happened with that sort of yellow scarf thing and whatever, I thought that was really illuminating. And I thought that, as he usually does, I thought Bob Williams had some really cutting, interesting things to say about what was going on. So all in all, I mean, I was very happy when it happened. I think it had to happen regardless. It is really too bad that you know, it had to happen in a way that left scars. But I don't think that scarring runs all that deep as it's been made out to run.
So you mentioned that that you think it's Clark that will win the liberal leadership, right?
I'm not a political prognosticator or an expert pundit. I haven't really looked at the. I just have the sense that she'll probably win. That would be. I mean, if I were laying a bet, but I mean, we always know. I mean, we know it can go any which way.
Yeah, and so I guess with Farnsworth, is it Farnsworth or Farnworth?
I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think it is Farnsworth.
Okay,
I
remember, sorry. Yeah,
I can't even remember now. Anyway. He's only been in politics what 30 years.
Right.
He's the front runner. I guess he's the guy to beat in the NDP race, right?
Yeah, he's the guy to beat. And I mean, my guess is that what'll happen is that there'll be a field of candidates, and that what it'll come down to is it'll be probably Adrian Dix on one side and Mike Farnsworth on the other, and that those will be the two who really are kind of, you know, seen to have a chance. And I hate to circumscribe, you know, the conversation like that, because it's I do think that leadership contests should be a time when ideas are really first and foremost, and that, you know, foregone conclusions are the enemy of that kind of openness and actual open conversation. And I think, like, kind of a shit disturber candidate in the NDP raising some of these issues, that wouldn't be a bad thing at all. And some of the people who've stepped forward, you know, I think have had some really great things to say, like that at Simon's guy, you know, so I don't want to discount them. I do think, though, that at the when all is said and done, you know, it'll probably come down to Adrian Dix versus Mike Farnsworth, and I think that's the sense that I get, that people are kind of preparing for ultimately for that showdown.
So if it's not about ideas, is it a generational change that we're seeing at both parties then?
I don't know. I mean, I you know, so much of it is just, it's this kind of heady mix of ideas, yeah, but also, you know, just kind of naked power politics, and you have, at the end of the day, the two parties, you know, are on the one hand thinking, okay, look, we cannot lose another election. They're never going to be this ripe for the picking again, so whatever we do, we have to pick the person who can win. And, you know, the other party is saying, look, we want to cling to power in by whatever means that we can. I mean, that's always what the incumbents are thinking, and pretty much always what the opposition is thinking. But, I mean, this time you have people in the NDP, because they're in power so infrequently, when they see numbers like this, they get a little drunk off them. I mean, it just becomes, you know, you are kind of resigned to the idea that you're spending your political life on the side that doesn't get to win. And then somebody comes along with a set of numbers that you know, seems to indicate that at least you stand a pretty good chance. Well, you'll suddenly, what happens too often is that suddenly you're everything is subsumed by that. And I kind of feel like I'd rather the NDP lose in a way that leaves the party knowing what it stands for and why it exists, than to win and get in and have no idea why it's there or what it's doing. And then that's why, like, you know, the 2009 loss, you know, the problem wasn't so much the loss. I mean, of course, you're in to win, and I'm not, you know, I'm not trying to be Pollyanna about that. Obviously, winning matters. You have to get in to put yourself into a position to enact the policies that you want to see made. But when Carol James lost, I mean, it wasn't even like, it was like the NDP lost and had no idea what it was. Like, what are we? Are we just like that kind of anti-tax, you know, anger vote? Like, are we really just the party that doesn't like the carbon tax? Like, what was the reason for the party's existence? You know, and people can console themselves in a loss if they understand, you know, why they did what they did. But if you sacrifice everything to what you perceive as real politic, and you let, you know, communications experts and pollsters eviscerate your party and empty it of all meaning, and then on top of that you lose, that's why people are staggering around punch drunk. I mean, because there's not even a hook to hang your hat on, like, anymore. You just lose, and all there is loss. There's not even a set of beliefs. So, you know, I think what's most important is for parties to just kind of be honest about what they want. And part of that means is, like, you know, I certain groups in society will do better with various parties. I mean, that's why those parties exist. So is it really the worst thing in the world to say that, yeah, a mining magnate is going to do better with the BC Liberals in power, and a minimum wage worker will do better with the NDP? Like, why do those two parties have to pretend that each cares about the mining magnate and the minimum wage worker equally?
Right.
But by the way, not that the NDP has given any indication that they care about minimum wage workers more than mining magnates. I use those examples in a kind of, like, you know, as hypotheticals, but I think that, you know, I don't want to give the impression that I think the NDP is, you know, the party of Woody Guthrie or something. I mean, they've, and I understand that partly that's what happens at the provincial level, and it's what happens in a two-party system.
Yeah. Now, digressing dramatically here.
Sorry.
Well, what's your favorite Woody Allen movie?
Oh, my favorite Woody Allen movie? I mean, it's really tough to, I would maybe, like, ask to be given, like, a favorite dramatic and a favorite comedic. I mean, it really changes from year to year. I mean, for a long time, Manhattan was my favorite. And I think that, you know, it's recently been kind of edged out by Hannah and Her Sisters, although that might be a function of the fact that I can't find my copy of Hannah and Her Sisters.
Right.
And I've lent it to somebody. I have no idea who has it. And so maybe, like, absence makes the heart grow fonder, but I love those ones. And Hannah and Her Sisters is probably the best in terms of, you know, the combination of drama and comedy. Although we went and saw the new one this last year, the You Will Meet a Tall Dark Stranger.
Yeah.
And I thought it was very good. And I had seen Whatever Works, the Larry David one,
yeah,
and I just thought it was just terrible. Like, I was so disappointed with it, because I love those guys, and, you know, that's the funny thing about comedy, right? I mean, if you have a basketball team that has Shaquille O'Neal and Kobe Bryant on it, you will win. Like, and if you have a hockey team that has both, you know, Sidney Crosby and Ovechkin, but, like, you will probably win. Like you can take the two best people at anything in sports, and they will generally. But if you take a comedy and you take Larry David and Woody Allen, you know, who, if you were to find two funnier guys in the last, like, 30 years, I mean, would be a challenge.
Right. Yep.
And they can make an absolute turd of a movie. And, you know, I guess that's one of the things that keeps comedy exciting, is to know that, you know, even giants never, you know, it's never guaranteed.
Charlie, you're good to do this. I appreciate it.
Oh, no, my pleasure. Thanks very much, Joseph. And thanks for all your support of Vancouver Special. I really appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Charles Demers, the author of Vancouver Special and The Prescription Errors, on the line in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plato.